This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Waves of Mexican immigration to the U.S. date back to around the turn of the 20th century. At the start of the Mexican Revolution, groups of Mexicans moved to the U.S. They quickly became an important part of the blue-collar workforce. Some communities welcomed them, others did not. Mexican immigrants have also played a big role in the development of North Carolina. Julie Wise is a professor of history at the University of Oregon. She wrote Corazon de Dixie, Mexicanos in the U.S. South since 1910, and she joins us now. Julie Wise, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks so much, Frank.
1910, the Mexican Revolution, so naturally you can expect a flow of refugees. Many came to the U.S. Before that, were there many Mexicans in America?
Well, there were certainly Mexican Americans living in America in the U.S. Southwest, which of course had formerly been a part of Mexico. And those people were all granted citizenship in 1848 when the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was signed. There had also been small numbers of migrants from Mexico to the United States, including to the port of New Orleans. However, it was not really until the Revolution that we started to see the large-scale migrations that have really continued to this day.
And where did they go in the U.S. In 1910?
Well, the first stop for most Mexican immigrants in that period was South Texas. From there, they would either perform agricultural labor or be recruited to really everywhere else in the United States. And certainly what we're seeing in recent times is the spreading out of Mexican and other Latino immigrants throughout the country. There was actually a parallel phenomenon in the 19-teens and particularly the Roaring Twenties when Mexican immigrants were recruited throughout the United States from they were recruited to Alaska, to Pennsylvania, to Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, to California. And so they had often their home base in South Texas, but they would be recruited really pretty much anywhere that labor was needed, particularly agricultural labor.
Well, I want to talk more about that flow, migration through the U.S. after they arrived. But what about at the border at the moment that they're crossing? What was their reception in South Texas, for instance?
Ah, that's a wonderful question. Well, for the most part, the large expanse of the border was unpatrolled at that time, really was unpatrolled until, frankly, the Clinton administration in the 1990s. So those who crossed at official crossing points would go through often humiliating health inspections, would be deloused with chemicals, that kind of a thing. Once they were in the United States, they were treated ultimately in South Texas in what was a Jim Crow system in which there were separate Mexican schools, separate Mexican drinking fountains and restaurants. They were treated as second-class citizens. And within the labor market, they were heavily exploited as low-wage workers. And that was why many were very receptive to recruiters who tried to take them to places like the Mississippi Delta or California or Michigan, was because the conditions in Texas were so difficult and often quite violent on the part of their employers, who really wanted to make sure that they didn't go anywhere and that they were captive workers.
Generally speaking, who was moving from Mexico? Were these sort of middle-class, white-collar workers? I mean, who were the folks who made that first wave of migration to the U.S.?
There were several different groups. One group was more of a middle-class group. Some of them had more conservative tendencies. And they would set up shop in places like El Paso and Los Angeles and San Antonio to be accountants and doctors and serve the Mexican immigrant population. However, what we saw, particularly once we got into the 1920s, was but also in the 1910s, was really a diverse group of people who either their homes and livelihoods and villages had been destroyed in the violence of the Revolution. They were also people who had been left behind. The Revolution overthrew a regime that had been very authoritarian and promoted great economic progress in Mexico, but often at the expense of the poor. And so many of the people that were left behind by that economic expansion sought to pursue their own economic expansion by moving to the United States, where they believed they could earn more money and create a better life for their families and or earn money to bring back to Mexico.
Well, you talked about, you know, South Texas, this kind of Jim Crow system that was set up. Things apparently were a little bit better in New Orleans, where other waves of migrants settled. Tell us more about that.
Yes, absolutely. What I found is that New Orleans is, you know, historians are still researching these histories. It's very recent that historians are even looking into this, really, just in the last 40 years. But what I found is that New Orleans so far is the only city that we've identified where Mexican immigrants were not physically segregated into their own neighborhoods, and also where they were not segregated in the labor market, where they occupied a wide range of positions. And I think that's for several reasons. One is that it was an immigrant city, a port city. But then again, Chicago was an immigrant city. Los Angeles was an immigrant city. And Mexicans ended up facing much greater discrimination in those places. I think another dimension is that New Orleans at this time is really eyeing Latin America as an important part of its economic future in terms of trade and taking advantage of its status as a port city and trying to beat out port cities like Galveston or Tampa for that business with Latin America. And so you really see leaders in New Orleans, for example, writing letters to the federal government and saying, you know, those humiliating health inspections, well, we can't have those on the boats coming from Latin America because we don't want businessmen to get caught up in that. And we want to make sure that Latin Americans feel New Orleans is open to them so that that trade route can stay very active and fruitful for us.
Did this mean there was a range of job opportunities then for these migrants from white collar to blue collar work available?
Yes, absolutely. So some would go into import-export, taking advantage of that connection to Latin America. But over time, we saw increasing numbers of poorer Mexican immigrants who would go to New Orleans and work largely in the service industry as cooks and busboys, work in industries like construction and dredging of canals. So yes, there was a wide range of opportunities. And while segregation was never as pronounced in New Orleans as it was in newer cities like Atlanta or, let's say, Raleigh, Mexican immigrants still were more predominantly living among either native-born whites or white immigrants than they were among African Americans.
You also contrast the conditions to Mississippi, where segregation and violence were very likely, and again, Mexican populations set over and against black communities. Tell us more about that.
Sure. So if we go back even to emancipation, we see that white Southern planters were trying to recruit immigrants to their plantations in order to try to replace their black labor force and or show their black labor force, hey, if you don't do this work at this price, we don't need you. We've got someone else that can do it. And so, and they were very explicit that when they recruited groups such as Chinese, it was really for that purpose. So no surprise, eventually they see all the Mexican workers picking cotton in the Southwest and they want a piece of that labor source. They want a piece of that action. When Mexicans arrived in Mississippi, of course, they'd been recruited from South Texas, trying to escape the violence of South Texas, and were made great promises of all the wonderful wages that they would receive and the conditions they would have. When they arrived in Mississippi, they saw it was not that way, and they were subject to extreme violence and oppression, just as African Americans were. For example, if they tried to leave the plantation, they might be killed or jailed. However, what Mexican immigrants had that African Americans did not was a government that was willing to back them up. And so many made appeals to Mexican consulates in New Orleans and also in Texas for the Mexican government to intervene and investigate the situation. And over time, planters were actually forced to treat Mexicans a bit better than African Americans if they wanted the labor force to keep coming.
Did this happen because of direct intervention? In other words, the consulate may make an appeal to local authorities in Mississippi, or did it happen by way of federal authorities then putting pressure on the local authorities in places like Mississippi?
Both. So what happened in some cases was that word would get back to Texas that people were being forced to stay on a particular plantation. In Texas, the Mexican consulate would alert Mexico City, the federal government, which in turn would contact Washington, D.C. to open an investigation into what was known as peonage, unfree labor. So there are some cases like that. However, in other areas, you saw the Mexican government making direct appeals to local authorities. For example, when Mexican children were excluded from the white school, that was handled between the Mexican government and the governor of Mississippi. And in fact, the Mexican children were eventually admitted to the white school after that appeal.
Your book focuses on Mexican migration to the American South, but it's interesting because you also talk about migration from there to the rest of the United States, all over the country, as far away as Alaska. Tell us about these recruitment efforts and what was going on in various other parts of the country.
Do you mean in the early part of the 20th century,
yes,
around the 1920s? Sure.
Yeah.
Well, these were largely migrant circuits. So a typical circuit, frankly, through the 1960s and 70s even, a typical circuit might have been spending the winter in Texas, then going to somewhere like Mississippi or Arkansas to plant cotton in, let's say, February, March, April, then going up to the upper Midwest in the summer to pick fruits, and then eventually going back to the South to pick the cotton, that they had planted in the spring. They would now pick it in the fall and then return to Texas for the winter. So there were these routes that were developed by migrant workers that were advantageous for them and that met the needs of their families and allowed them to have some form of income for most of the year and then to have a couple of months in the winter to spend with family in Texas or in Mexico.
How were Mexican migrants treated in Northern? Was it different from place to place? And I guess that's the first question. Regionally, how did things differ? And then over time, what time periods did we see differences in the way Americans treated Mexican immigrants?
On the one hand, there were absolutely regional differences. It was different to be Mexican in South Texas, where in some certain areas they were the majority, which created a lot of fear among white people that if Mexicans weren't controlled with extreme violence, they might rise up and resist, which in fact happened at various points in the 19-teens, versus a place like, let's say, Michigan, where Mexicans were migrant workers that were largely invisible, versus a place like Mississippi, where they were there but amidst a very large black population, which was the primary concern of white power holders. So on the one hand, the treatment differed in many different places. On the other hand, there are certain themes that we see, which is essentially that many of the racial ideas of the time that promoted negative sentiments about African Americans or Asian Americans were also applied to Mexican Americans. So you saw pretty much consistently segregation of Mexican Americans across the board, Los Angeles, Chicago. Often they would live among other sort of in-between immigrants, such as Italians or Jews or Poles in those cities. And so you saw, on the other hand, some consistent themes of Mexicans being considered racially inferior during this time period.
You often see correlations between changes in the economic fortunes of the U.S., the Roaring Twenties versus the Depression of the 30s, and in the way marginalized populations are treated. Was this true for the Mexican population as well?
Yes, absolutely. Not in necessarily a simple way, but absolutely. So we saw in the 1920s, for example, that everyone was very eager to recruit Mexicans to their various locations in the Roaring Twenties. Of course, when the 1930s came, we saw massive deportation efforts that took place largely in the Southwest, but also elsewhere as a result of the Depression and local governments not wanting those people on their welfare rolls. Interestingly, in a place like Mississippi, they didn't have them on the welfare rolls anyway. They didn't have those types of local benefits to the same extent. And so you actually didn't see deportation efforts in Mississippi, or really much in New Orleans for that matter. Many Mexicans in Mississippi were simply abandoned without work during the Depression. With that said, by the end of the 1930s, there are Mexicans once again being recruited to perform cotton labor in Mississippi. And so even in these moments of downturn, you often see that there's still perhaps a slow stream of recruitment of Mexican workers. And frankly, if we look at our recent time period of some of the anti-immigrant sentiments that we're seeing now, I date those really to the mid-2000s, which was actually a very prosperous economic time when we started to see the beginnings of our current anti-immigrant movement.
Well, you spend the last chapter of your book looking at North Carolina and the story of public schools and the exurbs in the 1990s and 2010. Tell us about, particularly in Charlotte and Mecklenburg.
Yes, absolutely. So what we saw in the 1990s was that Mexican migration to the Charlotte area largely went to the city of Charlotte itself, where Mexican immigrants and other Latino immigrants who joined them were very much welcomed in a sentiment that was led by the business community. And I recently wrote in an op-ed in the Raleigh News and Observer about how Governor McCrory was very enthusiastic at that time about this workforce coming to his city. However, what we saw over time was that those workers moved out of the city, and or as women and children came, families were more likely to settle in places that had a lower cost of living and a calmer pace of life, not only in inner suburbs, but also in exurbs, in places like Indian Trail in Union County, in parts of Gaston County, of course, also in places like Gastonia and Monroe. And what happened when they got to those places is that they encountered white families who had moved into largely new construction homes in the 1990s and 2000s, seeking in some sense an escape from some of the diversity of the Charlotte area, as well as, of course, just a lower cost of living. These were people who wanted to move into areas where taxes would be low, schools would be good, and where they could have a certain middle class lifestyle. And what they found when they got there is that about a half a mile from their beautiful new construction home was a trailer park full of Latino families whose children were then going to attend the same school as them. And for people who had moved into these areas, specifically in the hopes of paying as little taxes as possible to achieve as much as possible for their children through the school system, they became very incensed that this other group of people, whom many considered were undeserving or perhaps mistakenly believed were not paying taxes, were then there near their homes attending the same schools as their children.
That reversed some of the feeling from the grassroots level. And you mentioned now Governor McCrory, but then Mayor McCrory of Charlotte, mm-hmm. being among the leaders in the business community, welcoming certainly the labor that built Charlotte into the city it is today. But you say now, if you take a look at this, at the anti-sanctuary movement and anti-sanctuary legislation, I think one of the interesting points was that the city police under Mayor McCrory had a much kind of hands-off policy toward immigration, not looking at their legal status, whereas Mecklenburg County Sheriff, on the other hand, was much more aggressive. So under Mayor McCrory, there was a virtual sanctuary for those that labor that was coming into the city. And you point out the difference today when he signed the anti-sanctuary legislation.
Absolutely. And I don't know the extent to which Governor McCrory controlled that decision, that was made by the Charlotte police. What I do know is that he benefited greatly from it, that by that welcome mat being out, by word getting out, and people have told me over and over in interviews, we came here from Los Angeles, we came here from Texas, we came here from Chicago, because we heard this was a good place to raise a family where we were not going to be harassed by immigration agents or by police officers. And that was the case, and there were very powerful people that made that happen, including Senator Jesse Helms at the time. And there were very powerful people who benefited from that by the fact that North Carolina had, at the time, perhaps the most positive reputation of any state among Mexican immigrants when they were deciding where they could have a safe and good environment in which to work and raise their families. And so they came, and that provided the labor force that built the downtown Charlotte that's there today.
What do you think accounts for that? Because North Carolina is not the only state to have this this fierce anti-immigrant policy, the anti-sanctuary policy. Other states are following suit, north and south. What's happening today? What are the changes today that account for this?
I think that what's happened is that, unfortunately, what was once a great amount of diversity in the Republican Party about the immigration issue, even as recently as 10 years ago or the administration of George W. Bush, has really turned into a uniformity around this anti-immigrant sentiment, suddenly becoming more of a litmus test in the Republican Party. And I think what we've seen is that while there used to be strong voices from the business community advocating for Mexican immigration to continue, strong voices from within both urban areas and agricultural areas that were very dependent on that labor force, that those voices have really been drowned out by some of these more populist voices that are much more concerned about what they perceive as the depletion of their tax dollars for people whom they consider to be undeserving. Of course, it turns out that 75% even of undocumented immigrants do pay taxes, but most people don't know that. And so, unfortunately, this more populist anti-immigrant sentiment has really drowned out a lot of the more diversity that we used to see on the right. And so, therefore, even if you represent an agricultural area where the farmers are very dependent on Latino laborers and are telling you, we don't want enforcement here, we don't want anything that's going to cause people to leave our area, if you have any aspiration to a larger office, as we see Pat McCrory eventually did, you basically need to vote on the party line on these things on these anti-immigrant initiatives in order to have the proper record to show that you've been consistently anti-immigrant throughout your career. So unfortunately, this one part of the Republican Party seems to have taken over what used to be a much greater diversity of voices. Also from the evangelical community, a much greater diversity of voices used to exist.
My guest is Julie Wise, a professor of history at the University of Oregon. Julie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Her book is Corazon de Dixie, Mexicanos in the U.S. South since 1910. You can find out more about it at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a photographer takes a look back at the Lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Please stay with us.